call to order the Commerce Committee meeting, and we do have a quorum, and ask Representative Cagle, sorry, Vice Chair is not here, would you move the minutes?
Mr. Chair.
Excuse me? Representative Brindley.
We do not have minutes in our packet, and nor were they posted online. We haven't seen those.
The committee administrator has sent them around, but we can wait if you want, and they've been posted. But we can also, if you want a chance to review them before we take the motion, we certainly can do that.
Oh, they just came through.
Well, tell you what, they were posted a few hours ago, but we will wait on the minutes and take action on them later in the meeting so that you have an opportunity to review them. Representative Driscoll, you look like you wanted to say something.
Yeah, just a moment, Mr. Chair. So we're not getting hard copy for people who are here that may not have had a chance to see them as well?
I think that is the usual practice. I think today we have them in electronic form. We'll make sure they're in hard copy, generally speaking. But
thank you, Mr. Chair.
We will not take action on now. We'll wait until later in the meeting. Members, we have a few items on our agenda today, first of which is an overview of the gaming industry in Minnesota. We are very honored to have tribal leadership with us today, which we'll get to momentarily. But before we do that, I think Representative Tabke has a few remarks to make. Representative Tabke.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And because we are talking about gaming and other land issues today, Mr. Chair, given the nature of the hearing today, though important on any day as Minnesotans and as leaders, we recognize that we are meeting on the traditional lands of the Dakota and Ojibwe peoples. And we make this acknowledgement to honor the Dakota and Ojibwe people who have guided and stewarded this land throughout generations, and to honor their ancestors, elders, and descendants, as well as the land itself. We recognize the acts of genocide committed against the Native people and acknowledge Indigenous people are still here and present all around us, and their voices should be uplifted. So thank you very much, Mr. Chair, for that opportunity.
Well, thank you, Representative Tabke, for that really important acknowledgement. So with that, we will welcome Chief Executive Benjamin to the committee. It's a great honor to have a tribal leader in our committee. So thank you for coming today, and the floor is yours.
Anin Bouju, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Melanie Benjamin, and I am the chief executive for the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe, one of the 11 sovereign nations located here in the state of Minnesota. Thank you for your invitation to appear today to offer a tribal perspective on gambling in Minnesota. While our next speaker will provide background on the historical and legal basis for Indian gaming, my comments will focus more directly on the impacts of tribal gaming for the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe, East Central Minnesota, other tribal communities, and Minnesota's economy as a whole, especially in the rural areas of the state. Tribal gaming provides resources for our tribal nation to address community needs. It also provides many jobs for non-Indians in our region. Over the past 20 years, we have been one of the largest employers in the two counties where our casinos are located. It is important to note tribal gaming is government gaming. Tribes do not operate casinos for private profits. Our profits stay right here in Minnesota, where they support tribal government, communities, and members. Tribal gaming proceeds serve as an essential tax base for tribal governments. These revenues allow tribes like the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe to be self-sufficient in our efforts to provide education, healthcare, housing, cultural resources, infrastructure, and other vital programs and services to our members. In the case of the Mille Lacs Band, our tribe operates two gaming properties: Grand Casino Mille Lacs in Mille Lacs County and Grand Casino Hinckley in Pine County. Pre-pandemic, we employed 3,400 employees in our casinos and then another 800 in our governmental operations. But today we currently employ approximately 2,200 associates in our casinos and another 800 in our tribal government. We are proud to be a major provider of health insurance and retirement benefits to the people of the region. We also own and operate other businesses, making us, the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe, the largest taxpayer in the Pine County and one of the largest taxpayers in Mille Lacs County. Yes, you heard that right. We are taxpayers. Many of our businesses operate on land that is not held in trust by the federal government. So we pay nearly $2 million in property taxes annually on the lands in Mille Lacs, Pine, and Aiken counties. We also share liquor sales, tobacco, motor vehicle, and other taxes collected on the Mille Lacs reservations within the state of Minnesota, which in turn shares them with local governments. Local communities also benefit from our gaming operations in ways that go far beyond job creation. For example, local hospitals have expanded in part because Grand Casino Mille Lacs provides health insurance benefits to area residents who may not have had insurance before. Local utilities have increased their power output to accommodate the casino's electrical needs, reducing costs for residential ratepayers. Grand Casino Mille Lacs and Grand Casino Hinckley paid approximately $6.6 million for the utilities in 2021. The band has invested in community infrastructure, economic development, and other benefits for the entire region. We are an important economic catalyst throughout East Central Minnesota. In fact, if you look at rural Minnesota, you will see that virtually every tribal casino in a rural community is the largest or among the largest employers in its home county. All across Minnesota, Indian gaming and governmental operations employ thousands of people, pay millions of dollars in insurance and other benefits, purchase hundreds and millions of dollars from Minnesota-based vendors and suppliers, pay millions in property and other taxes, and donate millions of dollars every year to community organizations beyond our reservation boundaries. This is what I call the good neighbor impact. The Mille Lacs Band, like other Minnesota tribes, is proud of what we have accomplished with our government gaming operations and how we have accomplished it. We are successful in large measure because Minnesota consumers have honored us with their trust and confidence. Minnesota residents remain supportive of Indian gaming as the integrity of our gaming operations has earned the trust of our players. This is warranted because we are the most highly regulated of any form of gaming in the state. Minnesota tribal gaming is regulated by five different governmental agencies. First, the tribal governments themselves, which have laws in place to establish and regulate gaming on tribal land, licensed vendors and key employees, provide security and surveillance, and manage day-to-day gaming operations. Second, the Department of Interior, which must approve all tribal state compacts in order for tribes to offer casino-style gaming and approve any net revenue allocation plans. Third, the National Indian Gaming Commission, which approves key gaming contracts, enforces federal gaming regulations, and enforces civil penalties against tribes for violations of those regulations. Fourth, the Department of Justice, which conducts background checks on all key gaming employees, investigates and enforces potential criminal violations of federal law at tribal casinos. Fifth, the state of Minnesota, which negotiated and has enforcement authority over provisions of the tribal state compacts. Let me close by saying that the Mille Lacs Band appreciates the opportunity to appear before you today. We are proud of the progress we have made over the past 30 years and the quality and the integrity of our gaming operations. We are committed to preserving the economic lifeline of tribal gaming so we can address the problems that remain unsolved and the challenges that remain unmet. Thank you very much for your time today and listening. Miigwech.
Thank you, Chief Executive Benjamin. As I said, we are really honored to have you in the committee today. Appreciate your time and look forward to working with you and your community as the legislative season progresses.
Thank you very much.
Our next testifier is Andy Plato with the Minnesota Indian Gaming Association. Mr. Plato.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the Commerce Committee. My name is Andy Plato, and I serve as the Executive Director of the Minnesota Indian Gaming Association, known as MIGA. MIGA is currently made up of 9 of the 11 federally recognized Minnesota tribes who manage gaming operations across the state. Modern tribal gaming started when tribes, exercising their inherent governmental authority, began offering casino-style gaming. The state of California objected and sued. The litigation led to the landmark 1987 U.S. Supreme Court decision, California versus Cabazon. This Cabazon decision unequivocally affirmed that tribes, as sovereign governments, have the inherent right to conduct gaming activities on tribal lands, state law notwithstanding. Soon after, Minnesota tribes created MIGA to educate and advocate on behalf of Indian gaming as an economic development tool for tribes. Of course, states, alarmed about tribal gaming, complained to Congress. And so a year later, Congress passed the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, or IGRA, which restricted tribal sovereignty by requiring tribes to negotiate compacts with their states in order to conduct casino gaming. Minnesota tribes quickly responded to the new law, and once tribes agreed not to offer popular casino games such as roulette, craps, and keno, Governor Perpich signed slot machine compacts with all 11 Minnesota tribes. 2 years later, Governor Carlson signed blackjack compacts with those same tribes. From that time forward, MIGA has protected the viability of tribal gaming by opposing expansion of commercial or state-sponsored casino games. The goal was to give tribes the ability to implement tribal gaming as an indispensable economic development tool. Inevitably, commercial gaming interest groups began to pressure the legislature to authorize casino gambling as part of their business. Thus, we saw campaigns to put slot machines in bars, at racetracks, and in casinos at the Mall of America and in downtown Minneapolis. These expansion efforts failed, partly due to tribal opposition, but also because charitable gaming, religious, and problem gambling groups also objected. However, it's important to note, tribes have made certain accommodations over the years at the request of state officials, allowing certain games previously reserved for the tribes. In 2001, MIGA tribes did not oppose efforts to legalize poker and other card games at racetracks. And then again in 2012, when the legislature was searching for ways to fund the Viking Stadium, MIGA responded to 2 requests from then Governor Dayton. First, the Shakopee, Mittawakat, and Sioux tribe agreed to subsidize Canterbury Park racing purses and permit tracks to offer non-banked blackjack games. In return, Canterbury withdrew its support for slots at the track, and both sides honored that agreement for the past 10 years. Second, and again at then Governor Dayton's request, and although not all tribes agreed, MIGA withdrew its opposition to electronic pull tabs, which ultimately became the main stadium funding source. In return, the legislation explicitly required that e-pull tab devices and games must only be electronic facsimiles of paper pull tabs, must be opened like paper pull tabs, and must not mimic slot machines. Unfortunately, over the last several years, e-game features have advanced rapidly, and state regulators have approved games with features that never existed in the paper format and clearly mimic slot games, something the 2012 law specifically sought to prevent. As matters now stand, video slot machines are the only games that tribes have the exclusive legal right to offer, and without them, tribal casinos would no longer be economically viable. As Chief Executive Benjamin pointed out, gaming revenues, primarily from video slot machines, are the main tribal government funding source for education, clinics, housing, public safety, and other essential government services. But this is a fragile revenue stream that the state can choose to unilaterally erode at any time. Looking to the future, tribes are open to legislative action on gaming issues that will strengthen the industry, including legal regulated sports betting. MIGA looks forward to further conversations with the committee on the topic to ensure that any changes in the state's gaming laws support tribal communities and do not threaten critical revenue streams. Please remember, for the last 30 years, in spite of no direct state support, tribal gaming activity has significantly benefited the state's economy while caring for tribal members and providing jobs for thousands of Minnesotans. and around 85% of folks holding those jobs are non-tribal members living in the surrounding communities located mainly in rural Minnesota counties where good paying and consistent jobs with benefits are scarce. All of this is why the MIGA tribes work to keep tribal gaming a strong and effective economic tool for their governments, members, and neighboring communities. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members, for your time, and of course, stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Plato. Do members have questions for Mr. Plato? Seeing none, thank you very much. The next testifier we have is a dear friend of mine and mentor, Tim Mahoney of the Gambling Control Board. Welcome back. Yeah. And Director Mahoney, if you wanted to give all or part of your marks by yelling at any members of the committee, I think that that would be very welcome.
It can be done.
Hope we know.
You know, Mr. Chair, this is the first time I've been on this side with at the mercy of the chair and his member and his members. But I want to thank you. I'm not sure. Was I supposed to bring candy as the first? Oh, damn it. I'll send it. Don't worry. It's in the mail. I want to thank the chair and the members on both sides of the aisle. I have friends here on both sides. I've had conversations with both sides of this particular committee, and I'm happy to say we didn't end up looking like the last hockey game I was at. So, Mr. Chair, if I might, I'll just proceed, but I'd like to introduce my counterpart, my companion here. This is the business manager and HR manager at the Gambling Control Board, Laura Wade, and she has some remarks too. So, you said I had 5 minutes, but, you know, I'm not a politician, so I guess you can just gavel me quiet.
I'll look forward to that part of the hearing.
I know. I felt like I was kind of trying to mentor you, but it didn't work real well. You just went along with whatever you wanted to do.
Mr. Chair?
Representative O'Driscoll.
Are these part of his 5 minutes, I hope?
Hey, you know, there's got to be some humor here. Got to soften them up. Tell them a story, then you know. Members, the Minnesota Gambling Control Board regulates lawful gambling and the lawful gambling industry to ensure the integrity of gambling operations and guarantees the lawful use of gambling profits. Lawful gambling proceeds are used to support Minnesota veterans, fraternal groups, Lions Club, Moose Club, youth activities, fire and safety equipment for smaller cities, religious and community organizations, education, local units of government, community projects, all sorts of stuff. Lawful gambling may be conducted only by IRS or Minnesota registered nonprofits. Full licenses are issued to nonprofits with licensed gambling managers. These organizations may conduct all forms of lawful gambling. Paper and electronic pull tabs, paper and electronic bingo, raffles, paddle wheels, and tip boards throughout the entire year. The board also issues exempt permits to organizations who wish to conduct lawful gambling on a more limited basis. These organizations are not required to have a licensed gambling manager and are subject to much less regulatory scrutiny. I could go on that particular part, but I'll leave that one alone. Probably smart on my part. The Gambling Control Board is funded by the industry it regulates. This happens through regulatory and licensing fees. Our budget for this year was $5.1 million. The governor will be proposing in his budget the funds that we will have for our budget next year. I've made my request to the governor and the governor's office, and they told me that they will give me their answer next week. I guess I'm not more special than the public. The agency has an appointed 7-member citizen board, an executive director, and 45 full-time staff. Our central office is in Roseville, Minnesota, and we maintain regional offices in Mankato, Hibbing, and Fergus Falls. It's a great staff. and they work very hard. Using the regulations that you give us, I want to be that real clear. I don't propose legislation for regulation. That is your job, and I'm a regulator, and I will follow what you propose. Yeah, I just kind of went off script. Let me share two things that I'm really excited about this year related to the hard work that these folks are doing. Particularly excited about the idea of a new software system for our agency. I don't think it's been changed in 20 years. When I first looked at it, I was wondering if it was DOS-based. We are currently developing that software, and it should be ready by April 1st. We're going to take 2 months to test it to make sure that the small agency, the small location up in Halleck or down in whatever state you want, county you want it, is not fearful of it, not confused by it. This, it will make our data input, output, and analysis so much simpler and so much faster. As I said, it should be running and in purpose July 1st, 2023. And alongside that, so that's the fiscal year. We were gonna put it in earlier, but they said, could you please put it on, go live on the fiscal year. I don't know if any of you have looked at the website for the Gambling Control Board, but I think it was designed by a prehistoric person. I have set a goal, and many of my old colleagues know how well I was at the computer. Staff is laughing even harder than the members. I told them their job is to make it friendly enough that I could use it. It needs to be, someone needs to be able to get on that thing and figure out how to open up a gambling operation. And right now, I don't think they could. At the end of the last year, there were over 1,100 licensed organizations conducting gambling in Minnesota. 249 of these organizations were in the 7-county metro area, and almost 900 were in greater Minnesota. And lawful gambling took place at over 3,000 locations throughout the state. 733 of these sites were in the 7-county metro area, and almost 2,300 were in greater Minnesota. The numbers of these organizations varies year to year, but it's pretty consistent at the 1,100 organizations and 3,000 locations. Gross receipts had a total of $4.3 billion. That's before prizes. There was a 38% increase from fiscal year 21 and a 104 increase from fiscal year 20. They are on pace to reach $4.5 billion in gross sales. Less paper and electronic pull tabs account for 96% of all sales. And for the first time, electronic pull tabs gross receipts overtook paper pull tab receipts. This year, as of January 5th, electronic pull tabs had $924 million worth of sales, and paper had $846 million. Minnesota's licensed organization, it's been a good year for Minnesota licensed organizations. The sales locations that host their gambling operation and for the charities that they sponsor. Last year's licensed organization used lawful gambling to raise $1.3 million for their mission. Over $52 million was raised in the 7-county metro area, and almost $80 million was in greater Minnesota. It's important not to forget that last year, though, the taxes collected on gambling receipts reached $180 million for the state. The board and its staff continue to diligently provide the necessary oversight and regulation of this multi-billion dollar industry. Thank you for this opportunity to introduce the Gaming Board to your committee, and we look forward to working with you. Lots of additional information is available on the website that I can't really function on. I'd like to ask if my business manager and true person that runs the agency right now, HR person, and my business manager, Laura Wade.
Thank you, Ms. Wade. If you could proceed with your presentation.
I'll keep it short. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Since FY 2012, when electronic gaming was introduced, this industry has grown by over 300%, from $1 billion in gross receipts to just more than $4.3 billion in FY 22, like Director Mahoney said. In order to expand our regulatory efforts to match this dramatic growth in the industry, the Gambling Control Board has in the last 18 months used our FY 22-23 biennial budget request to add new staff members, including a new job category, which was responsible for targeting our permitted premises and making sure that operations that are visible to the public were in compliance with statute and rule. In calendar year 22, these five field agents completed 4,113 inspections at 2,446 sites throughout Minnesota, covering 58,000 miles, all to help ensure the integrity of charitable gambling. Though the GCB is a relatively small agency, we strive to have a big impact in creating the public trust that is vital to helping Minnesota charities support our communities. Thank you for the opportunity to share what we do at the Gambling Control Board.
Thank you. And now we'll give members an opportunity to ask questions of Gambling Control Board. I do, if I could just lead off by asking either Director Mahoney or Ms. Wade about, you know, we hear a lot in the charitable gambling space about the state's taxes that we impose on charitable gambling, and they are significant. I wonder if you could comment about the ability of local governments to participate in that from a tax perspective or a fee perspective.
Can I yell for this one?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members, the chair is referring to in-law cities with gaming operations in their jurisdiction can charge a 3% tax on their profits. They are supposed to use that for regulatory and compliance issues with these organizations. I don't have the number in front of me, but she does.
Do you have a statement?
No, I'll finish and let you go. Let you say what you think about it, but I'm going to get in trouble here. It's this one, right? Correct?
3%.
Yep. They charge the municipalities in, this is 3%. Okay. $1.3 million for inspections. We do inspections and compliance on almost all of the reports that are sent to us, and have to spend more time than I care repairing, getting them up to the standard that they need to be. So that's $1.3 million that we do it anyhow. I don't know why the cities need to do it. That might be lobbying. Sorry. And there's another tax that the municipalities can charge, ask for. I think they charge it. I'll call it that. There's a 10% that they are supposed to use for charitable operations, as I explained earlier. I haven't looked at that deep to tell you to have a strong opinion on it either way, Mr. Chair. Members, but that was $3.5 million.
So local units of governments can
take
extract
up 13%.
13% in addition to the money that goes to the state in tax revenue, in addition to other fees charged by the restaurants, for instance, in the form of rent. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. Yes, Mr. Chair.
And I guess the other question I have, is there restrictions on the amount of rent that can be charged on electronic pull tab operations by restaurants?
Can you repeat the question, sir?
Are there any restrictions on the amount of rent that can be charged? And I don't mean to hide the ball. What I understand is that there is no restriction on the amount of rent that can be charged if it's a bar-based electronic bull tab operation?
There are some restrictions. So, for example, if you have a booth operations, we would have caps for rent. But when it's a bar operation, then we do not have a cap, if I'm remembering correctly.
That's my understanding, too, that if it's a booth-based operation, there's a cap. There's not a cap for bar-based operations, and that can be a very significant amount of money. Director Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, I did do some research on the bar ops. They went from about $30 to $35 million in rents 5 years ago, was it, to about $75-77 million, no, less than 4 years. Almost, what is that, a 100% increase?
Pretty dramatic increase.
20% a year. So yes, that is a concern. I don't know how the charities feel about it, but as a gambling regulator, if you give us, we would not oppose some kind of regulation on rents.
Well, the charities will be coming up shortly. Maybe they'll tell us about that. Any other questions for Director Mahoney? Representative O'Driscoll, and while you're asking your question, I need to step away, so I'm going to turn the gavel over to Representative Patisa with you.
Dear Mr. Chair, I thought you were going to turn it over to me. That would have been a bargain. Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, and Director Mahoney, it's good to have you back here. I want to just comment that your disposition seems to be a lot more marked right now than it was a few years ago.
A lot more what, sir?
You and I have visited outside of the outside of these chambers and outside of these walls, and you seem to be enjoying retirement, and now we got you back to work here again. So,
yeah.
Statements are going to be more comment than they are a question. I want to remind people again that in charitable gaming in the state of Minnesota, they need to fill out a tax return, and it's probably the super easiest tax return to fill out because it's what are your revenues times your tax rate sent it into the state of Minnesota. We don't even need a full sheet of paper for it. We just have one line item on there times the tax rate. And the charitable gaming industry has taken a large blow during the COVID shutdown and other areas. And remember that when we talk about charitable gaming, we're talking about your local youth hockey, perhaps your fire association that's doing things to raise equipment, and there's a lot of folks who are vested in the community on these. And it's my hope that we will be able to, with our surplus, provide tax relief for these folks, because I can tell you that they've been not here in front of this committee during my tenure on commerce screaming about the rates that they're paying for rent. They're more concerned about the amount of taxes that they have to be paying on those revenues. Again, that really short tax return, how much did you make times the rate, send it in. And they're looking for tax relief more than they're looking for anything is what they're coming to me with. So, again, a comment just to kind of put this into perspective. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Director Mahoney, any follow-up?
Great statement.
Members,
no,
any?
He's right. They complain about, Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll. I have attended conferences. I have spoken in front of different clubs. They have a whole slew of issues, just like every other organization that comes in front of this or this body. It is up to you to pick and choose which part of the relief you're going to do and how you get there. I think there's many ways if you work and look and seek advice from the governor's office, we certainly can give you ideas or tell you what it actually we can regulate. Because we are a regulator, and there are proposals out there that we can't regulate, period. So we'll work with anybody. We get paid to be friends with all.
Members, any further question for Director Mahoney?
If I may, sorry.
Certainly.
Madam Chair, just as a point of context, we're talking about the 3% tax and the 10%. The 10% is actually a fund. It's not a tax. So cities or counties can ask for that 10% fund. It's a donation then to a city-administered fund, so it is not a tax. So just while we're talking about taxes, I want to just clarify. The 3% is a tax, and the 10% is a fund that they may donate up to 10% as required by ordinance.
Thank you for that clarification. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
All right.
And where's the sign at?
Next on the list, we have Kyle Gustafson, Executive Director of the Minnesota Racing Commission. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Kyle Gustafson, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Racing Commission. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today and give you an overview of the commission's functions. Minnesota has a strong horse racing industry, and the Racing Commission plays a critical role in protecting the public's interest to ensure the integrity of horse racing and card playing in the state. The commission does this by providing firm regulatory oversight and by providing for the safety of our human and equine participants. To fulfill its mission, the Racing Commission is engaged in all aspects of horse racing and card playing. First, the commission licenses all personnel who are involved at the racetracks and in the card rooms. So we license everyone from the owners, trainers, and jockeys to the card dealers, pit bosses, and other card room staff. Next, the Racing Commission ensures that the rules of the industry are enforced and followed. We do this in part through our race stewards and race judges who oversee each race, as well as by providing education to those who are involved. We also have a full-time set of investigators who are tasked with ensuring that participants are not engaged in prohibited activity that might give someone an unfair advantage and whose activity may undermine the integrity of horse racing and card playing. We also review any changes to card room plans of operations. Furthermore, the Racing Commission works to ensure the safety and welfare of our human and animal participants. To do so, each race season, we employ approximately 30 veterinarians and race technicians, and those vets perform pre-race examinations of horses, as well as collect samples after races to look for the presence of banned substances that might give a horse an unfair advantage, but also more importantly, could put a horse's health in danger. Additionally, the commission works to promote the horse racing and breeding industry in the state. As part of this function, the commission uses some of the fees that it collects to supplement purses of races. It also distributes over $700,000 in awards from the Minnesota Breeders Fund to breeding operations in Minnesota. More recently, the commission has also turned its attention to retired horse racing aftercare, and soon the commission will be distributing $200,000 in grants to horse race aftercare organizations. In a 2017 study that was commissioned by the Racing Commission, the U of M Extension Service concluded that the horse racing in the state has an over $400 million impact on Minnesota's economy and provides for over 5,000 jobs. Now, much of this is from direct spending of the horse industry, from salaries and whatnot for staff involved, and spending by owners and breeders and training operations, as well as the tracks. But an even more significant impact was felt in non-horse race relating industries, particularly in the agricultural sector and manufacturing sectors in greater Minnesota. I do want to note one of the significant topics amongst participants in the horse racing industry right now is the implementation and impact of the Federal Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Act. This was federal legislation that was passed in one of the COVID relief packages in the end of 2020. And this legislation only impacts thoroughbred racing at this time, so it only impacts the thoroughbred racing that's happening at Canterbury. Now, as I said, this legislation was passed at the end of 2020, but the first set of racing safety-related rules didn't go into effect until this last July. The next set of anti-doping and medication control rules were set to take effect this January. However, federal litigation on those rules put a pause on that implementation. We anticipate that those rules may go into effect as early as March, but that timeline is uncertain. As a result, the commission is proceeding toward this racing season with the contingency in place of those rules maybe being in effect, maybe not yet. Thankfully, Minnesota is in a good position to incorporate many of the new federal standards and regulations that have been either proposed or already put into effect, as the horse racing industry in Minnesota has long had a strong reputation for integrity and safety. In fact, many of the rules that have been proposed and implemented were modeled after what Minnesota racing has been doing for years. Nevertheless, HISA regulations do carry a significant price tag along with them, and the commission is currently reviewing its capacity to both fully implement the required rule changes as well as the costs associated with implementation. As this year's racing season approaches, the Racing Commission is committed to maintaining the state's strong reputation for integrity and safety in horse racing and card playing, And if anyone has an interest in coming out and seeing our operations firsthand and getting a better sense of how we operate and what we do, I invite you to do so. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Gustafson. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you for joining us for today and for your testimony. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Next, we have Rachel Jenner, the Executive Director of Allied Charities. Ms. Jenner, if you'd come forward and state your name for the record and proceed to your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rachel Jenner, and I am the Executive Director of Allied Charities of Minnesota. We represent the licensed charities who conduct lawful gambling in Minnesota. We advocate on their behalf here at the legislature and with their regulatory agencies. We also provide education and resources to help them with their operations and compliance. It is a highly regulated industry, and we have worked closely with the Gambling Control Board to make charities successful and maintain the integrity of our gaming. We really appreciate Director Mahoney, who reached out in his new role and has learned a lot about our industry and our members. Director Mahoney and his team have helped to understand our issues, and working with them helps us to better educate our members. We value their oversight and the relationship between Allied Charities and the Gambling Control Board. A lot of the numbers that I have put together for you are going to be a repeat of what Director Mahoney shared, so bear with me. We have 1,130 licensed charities, and they represent veteran service organizations such as VFWs and American Legions, fraternal and civic organizations, youth sports, and a variety of other charities serving in Minnesota. Last year, as he mentioned, our gross sales were $4.2 billion, which sounds like an amazing number, but keep in mind that our prize percentage is 85%. So after prizes, our revenue was $625 million. Of that, we paid tax of $180 million. Which was our largest expense. Our taxes have been an ongoing concern because with the progressive tax rates, each year that our revenues increase, our tax percentage increases. So as he mentioned, in 2022, that was a 50% increase, and it was a 100% increase in the last 2 years in our taxes. As an industry, our average tax rate is now 30%. And for a number of years, we've paid more in taxes than we have available for donations, which is of course concerning to our members. And we're hoping that in 2023, we will achieve tax relief. In 2022, our donations were $131 million. And in local communities, this has a huge impact. I hear from many small town clubs that they are the only ones in their area with the funds available to field all of the charitable requests that they receive. They're paying for extracurricular activities, a furnace for a family that's financially struggling, fire trucks, youth sports, updating playgrounds in their local parks, and grooming snowmobile trails to bring tourism into their small town. There are many VFWs and American Legions throughout Minnesota that are providing a community space that would not exist without the profits of charitable gambling. We have become a vital part of Minnesota. Charitable gambling is made up of a lot of different games, but as Director Mahoney stated, 96% is pull tabs and electronic pull tabs. So while we love a meat raffle and a bingo game in Minnesota, they are not profit centers for our charities. Electronic pull tabs is the fastest growing segment of our market, and for the first time ever in 2023, those revenues have exceeded our paper pull tabs. Paper pull tabs are more profitable for charities, and we make about 3 cents on every dollar wagered with electronics, mainly because of the high licensing fees that we're paying for the games. But with such a small profit margin, to be successful, we need electronic pull tabs along with continued high volume paper sales. Our goal is to allow the charities to maximize their profits in order to fulfill their missions. We're facing inflation, rising costs on all fronts, and a burden of our tax structure that has many organizations worried about their future. The future of charitable gambling must include electronic and paper pull tabs. I think electronics are the future of gambling because we see that everywhere, not just in our industry, but with the lottery and sports betting. I'm very proud of the success our organizations are having and how they are supporting so many causes in our communities. And I also would like to just mention on the local tax front, we do pay the 3% in many cities, and it is stated that they should refund any monies that they collect that are not spent on regulation. Some cities are doing that and some are not. So we've been working closely with the Gambling Control Board to ask those cities to refund the money. Some of them have over $100,000 in their accounts that have been collected and not spent on regulation. So we would like to see that changed. Some cities have voluntarily reduced the percentage that they're collecting, but not many. And as far as the 10%, it is a 10%. We in the industry call it a required contribution because they call it a contribution, but it is a requirement to do business in their city. So it's a required contribution.
Sounds like a tax.
Yeah.
a required contribution sounds like a great. Can we adopt my friends? Would you be more in favor of required contributions for income?
By any other name.
If we called the income tax a required contribution, would it make it? No, no, not working.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Driscoll.
Dare I say that sounds like pay to play?
You said it, not me. So I do have some questions, and I think maybe some other members do as well. You said on the electronic, you said 3 cents of every dollar wagered is made by the charities. That's astounding.
It is.
And of the remaining 97 cents, how much of that is I'm sorry, is that including?
So that's the dollar wagered. So 85 cents immediately goes back to the player, and we're left with 15 cents. And of that, we pay rent, which is typically, depending on whether it's a booth or a bar op, anywhere from 10 to 15%. We pay the taxes, which range from 9 to 36% on the gross. And then we have our expenses, just overhead expenses.
Well, I think you mentioned in your comments that a significant driver of that was licensing fees for the developers of the games.
Right. Cost of games is 31% on electronics.
31% on electronics. And is there a comparable number for paper?
I believe it's more like 25%.
Okay. The other question I wanted to ask you, I heard there might be some overlap. I think Director Mahoney alluded to between the inspection services and licensing regulation that the state is doing versus the local cities. What is your perspective on that overlap and whether it's necessary?
I think a lot of cities, the larger cities, tend to be the ones who participate in those fees and the tax for regulation, whether it's helping to offset costs for police to be involved at establishments or providing just as a officer to check in on things occasionally. Overall, I don't feel that it's a required or a necessary regulation to have them as well. As Director Mahoney stated, they're in our establishments. They are hiring more and more staff as the industry grows, and they're making it a part to be making site inspections on a regular basis.
I have one other question. I'm sorry to monopolize the question time, but as we talked earlier, there's a cap on rent for a booth operation versus no cap on rent for bar operations. And as I understand it, more and more the business model is moving to the bar operation, which has the uncapped rent. Can you talk about that phenomena, about movement from booth operations to bar operations?
Yeah, there is some concern in our industry that there's not a real clear definition of a bar operation other than that the bar operates the games, and that allows them to make uncapped rent, both with electronics and with paper pull tabs. So we've seen in the last couple of years more and more bars and larger operations converting to the bar op model because they have the opportunity to make 10 or 15% with no cap. And the cap on a booth is $1,750. And unfortunately, that was set a long time ago. It's not a cap that's tied to inflation or moves. So I think that that's becoming outdated in terms of, you know, how much they can make on a booth operation. So there is definitely incentive right now to convert to a bar op. But we have concerns that, you know, if it's a larger operation, we've now lost the ability to have full control over that operation and maintain the integrity of the operation and the responsibility of our license.
Thank you. Representative Cleavorn, did you have a question? No, Representative Katisa-Watune had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess my question is a little bit of a follow-up question to your last question about you're mentioning that, you know, people, places of business are converting from booth operation to bar operation. Right. Is that as simple as having a liquor license versus not having a liquor license? Or can you talk to me a little bit about what that process is?
The only step is to change the lease. So you're in a lease. They're typically, it's a month-to-month lease. All they need to do is sign a new lease stating that this is the way that the operation will be run. These are the forms of gaming that will be run at that establishment, and both parties sign. So that's not a process, really, in terms of converting.
Any follow-up for a second?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that explanation. It seems a little strange to me that would be, you know, as simple as just signing a piece of paper and then they can charge unlimited rent to this type of process. Thank you.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A more generic question, perhaps for you or nonpartisan staff. Do you know this tax revenue, is this going to the general fund?
Yeah, so the tax revenue on electronic poll tabs, as I understand it, and we do have fiscal staff here, but it goes to the stadium reserve account.
Yep.
This is what's
paying. And all of it does.
Not all of it. No. Ms. Eng.
Mr. Chair and members, Ashley Eng, I will have to get back to you on that.
And I don't know if House Research has a...
Mr. Chair and Representative New Brindley, it's not 100% of the contributions. There was a floor of, I think, $36.9 million that stays in the general fund, and then receipts above that do go into the stadium reserve account. So it's not 100%, but the calculation starts at anything over $36.9 million.
Great, thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And, maybe this is an area where I'll need more information kind of offline, but I'm new on this committee, and so I'm just wondering if you can talk to us very briefly about sort of how our system compares to other states. This whole thing that a lot of charitable groups seem to raise their revenue through gambling, and, you know, there's a constant stress about how much the taxes are and back and forth, but it kind of the underlying thing is that a lot of them seem to be relying on gambling for their revenue. And I just wonder, is that sort of an accurate perception that a lot of them are, and is that sort of common across the country that a lot of charitable groups are raising their revenue that way, if you know?
Unfortunately, I don't know in terms of, you know, nationwide if that's a common practice or not. I think a lot of it depends on the charity itself, how they raise funds. There are a number of charities who raise significant funds on their general side in addition to their gambling. But I think as these gambling numbers have grown over the years, there are a lot of smaller communities that they found that this is a very profitable way to fund their organization.
Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thank you. And I guess I really like to understand this a little, you know, at the really basic level. I think it would help contextualize some of these discussions about, you know, how much the expenses are and all of that, kind of like, what are we doing here with gambling as the way that we're raising money for all of these causes? And, you know, how is that really working for us as a state? I'm just really like to understand that a little better. Thank you.
Okay.
I see no further questions, so thank you, Ms. Jenner, for appearing today. Before we move to the overview of the banking industry, I wonder, and I see there's conversation over here, so I don't want to interrupt, but are we okay with going to the minutes now? Are you guys feeling good about the minutes? Okay. Representative Cagle, or I'm sorry, Representative Katisa-Watune here now. Would you move the minutes from the last meeting?
I would move the approval of minutes from January 11th, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Katisa-Watune moves approval of the minutes from January 11th, 2023. Any discussion to that motion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. We'll now move to an overview of the banking industry in Minnesota. And first we have Joe Witt, President of the Minnesota Bankers Association. Mr. Witt, if you would make your way to the podium and state your name for the record, proceed your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Joe Witt. I'm president and CEO of the Minnesota Bankers Association. I appreciate the opportunity to visit with you today about the banking industry. Wanted to tell you a little bit about our organization and then jump into what the Minnesota banking industry looks like. First, there's a lot of different financial services providers out there. We represent just banks, just chartered banks, either from operating here that operate in the state of Minnesota, either Minnesota chartered or otherwise. I do have a handout. You can follow along if you like. You might get to see some nice pictures of Minnesota with dots on it where our banks are located, and a chart that shows the number of charters, and it goes down. Fascinating stuff, so I know you'll want to follow along. Minnesota has 300, first, a little bit about our organization. We represent 95% of the banks in Minnesota. We're a trade group. We focus on improving the environment for banking in the state of Minnesota. So we lobby here in St. Paul. We lobby in D.C. We work directly with the regulators. We also get involved in court cases when we need to. We're a large trade group, relatively speaking. As far as the banking industry goes, we're able to provide a lot of products and services because we have a very strong membership base. One of the areas where we're especially strong is we do have four banking attorneys on our staff. They help provide services to our members, but also get heavily involved in our lobbying efforts. 316 banks, separately chartered banks, operate in the state of Minnesota. 263 of them are chartered in the state of Minnesota. The other 53 banks are chartered somewhere else, but they have an official FDIC branch here in the state of Minnesota, so they are counted in the 316. Of the 53, most of them are community banks. Most of them are operating in the states around us. For example, a bank in Wisconsin, Superior, Wisconsin, might have a branch in Duluth. A bank in Fargo might have a branch in up in Moorhead. In that number of 53 is also a number of large banks, Wells Fargo, U.S. Bank, Associated, BMO Harris, Huntington, the former TCF Bank. All of those banks obviously operate in Minnesota, but they're all chartered somewhere else. But they are counted in that 316 banks that are operating here in Minnesota. So of the 263 Minnesota banks, how does that number stack up compared to other states? Well, Minnesota actually has the third most bank charters in the country. We're very pleased with that. That gives lots of different opportunities for individuals, for families, and for businesses to find a bank here in the state of Minnesota. Even though we have the third most banks in the country, the number of bank charters here in Minnesota is dropping drastically. In the year 2000, we had 513 separately chartered banks. We now have 263. It's almost been cut in half since the year 2000. Why is that happening? Two main reasons. Number one, the cost of new regulations. Most of the regulations that we face are passed by Congress and set by the federal regulators. It's done at the federal level rather than the state level, but the cost of new regulations is significant, especially for the smaller banks. Secondly, cost of technology. We all know that there are cyber threats. We all know that there are ransomware and other things like that. Banks have to do an exceptional job of protecting their customers' data, and the cost of keeping up with technology and trying to stay one step ahead of those cyber thieves is significant. Banks need scale, and unfortunately the problem that we're running into is that these costs have become fixed costs, and it's harder for the smaller banks to survive. You will see lots of different regulated entities come before you in your committee, and the banks are definitely one of the most highly regulated entities that you will see. Banks have to fill out a report on their operations every single quarter. They're called call reports, And here's one of the differentiators that you'll see. We have extensive on-site examinations for the banks to make sure that they're complying with all the laws and regulations. There are a lot of the other financial services providers that don't have on-site exams, but the banks do, so that is a differentiator. Next slide on bank regulation. There, we have what's called a dual banking system. Banks can either be chartered by the federal government, and then they're called national banks, or else they can be state chartered banks. As far as the numbers go, the percentages, 21% of the banks are nationally chartered, national banks or else federal savings associations, and 79% are state chartered institutions. There are a lot fewer national banks, but generally speaking, they are the larger ones. So when you look at Wells Fargo, U.S. Bank, when you look at Huntington, all of those are national banks rather than state chartered banks. National banks are examined by the OCC, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. The State Department of Commerce that regulates state chartered banks does not have any authority to look at the national banks. It's exclusively with the OCC. Similarly, the laws that govern their operations, their branching, their rates they can charge on loans, all that stuff is set by federal law rather than state law. As the Commerce Committee of the Minnesota State Legislature, you have the ability to work with the Commerce Department on bank regulation and also to set the rules for the state chartered banks. And when you do set the rules, it is only going to be for the state chartered banks, not for the national banks. State chartered banks will be examined by the Minnesota Department of Commerce and by either the FDIC or the Federal Reserve. They alternate exams. Every 18 months there's an exam, and they do alternate whether your federal or your state regulator comes in to see you. Banks over $10 billion in assets are also examined by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau when we look at the consumer compliance issues. There's lots of different oversight. There's lots of different acronyms as we look at bank regulations. A couple different types of exams that we've listed out for you. The first one is safety and soundness. Right now, the banks are in a great position financially. They're operating in a safe and sound manner. A safety and soundness exam looks at what they call the CAMELS ratings, capital adequacy, asset quality, management, earnings, liquidity, and sensitivity to market risk. And right now, banks are in great shape. There's very few banks on the regulator's watch list that they're worried about from a perspective of whether or not they're healthy institutions. Second type of exams is a consumer compliance exam. Again, the banks are regulated for all the rules that are in place to protect consumers. Information technology I talked about. We did put together a slide on the next one, which is all the different consumer protection laws and regulation that are in banking. This is one of the major areas that has exploded over the last 20 years. There's lots of rules, lots of paper. This is why it takes so long for you to open up an account at a bank. This is why your mortgage packet is this thick. When you look at a mortgage loan, there's only two documents that the banks need. They need the promissory note that you sign that says you're going to repay the loan, and they need the mortgage document that gives a security interest in the house in case you don't pay your loan. Everything else is required by government regulations. So when you go through that process, other than those two, everything else is either in place because of a federal rule. Some of them are state rules, and some of them are local rules.
Mr. I'm sorry to interrupt, but if you could proceed down here. We're running out of time a little bit. Sorry about that. We went a little long.
On the last slide, it says thank you. I want to make sure you know that if you ever run into a banking problem, the people that are listed here are General Counsel Tess Rice and Teresa Kuvas, who is to my left. Would love to help you with any questions you have about any rules that come before you on banking, and would also like to help you if you ever run into a problem with any of your constituents and you want to get them some help in the banking industry. I apologize for going long, and I thank you for this opportunity.
Well, thank you, Mr. Witten. No need for an apology. We went long on the gambling side of the equation. Representative Katiza-Witun has a question. Representative
Katiza-Witun. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for the presentation. I just have a quick question. I hope it's quick, and we can certainly follow up offline if that's the case. But of the you know 316 banks here in with a location in Minnesota, do you happen to know if any of them or how many of them offer halal compliant loans?
Mr. Witt.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I do not know that off the top of my head. That would be a great one for us to take up offline.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Witt? Representative Kraft.
Mr. Chair, and Mr. Witt, on the trend of banks charters that has been dropping, are we different than other places in the country, or are you seeing that everywhere?
Mr. Witt?
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, we are not different in that regard. The percentage drop is about the same as you look at states across the country. We started with more banks, so we still have more than the rest of them, but there are some states that have, the state of Nevada has six Nevada chartered banks left. And other states are similar. A state like Arizona, I think, is down to 30 something. That doesn't mean that's the only banks that are in their state, obviously, but that's the number of their chartered banks. So some of the bigger national banks, like the Wells Fargo's and the U.S. banks, are in a state like that, too, but Nevada has just six charters.
Thank you.
Representative Lebar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and just maybe a follow-up on that. So how many have gone out of business, and how many have been consolidated into larger or I mean, we see consolidation in all industries, and I would assume banking would be the same. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative, you're exactly right. Banks just don't just go away. They are merged into another institution. So the number, for example, the number of office locations might not change. It's just the number of separately chartered entities. And because Minnesota has so many family-owned community banks, you know, it's difficult for, you know, when we see somebody that has been a fourth or fifth generation bank owned in the same family, it's sad to see them go away, is kind of the major thing we see.
And very briefly, Representative Cleaver.
Thank you very much. And then I just want to know if online banking has been impacted by the consolidation as well, or impacted by the drop of banks. Thank you.
Briefly answer that question.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would say no. I think the options for receiving banking services have continued to be very strong. So people are still able to get the banking services the way they want them.
Thank you, Mr. Witt, for being here today, and Ms. Kubas, we appreciate it very much. Look forward to working with you throughout this session. Next is Ryan Smith from the Credit Union Network. Mr. Smith, if you want to come forward and give some technical assistance to setting up your presentation. And we are running a little tight on time. We do have one more presenter after this, and then we will be taking up a bill, although I imagine the bill will go very quickly.
Oh. Mr. Chair, I mean, well, we have it in paper document. I mean, I'm fine just with timing. Oh, got it. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Smith.
I did have a high school English teacher that said that in Shakespeare's Hamlet, brevity is the soul of wit. I have to take their word for it, but I'm going to shoot for that today. Mr. Chair, members, it's great to see you all in person. It's been 3 years since I've been here, so in front of you in person. It's the first time I'm actually wearing pants, which is a good feeling, too. Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair, my name is Ryan Smith. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Credit Union Network. We're the trade association for credit unions in Minnesota, and we have a presentation for you here today. Just real briefly, talking about our industry, and then I'm happy to take any questions, more than likely offline. I just want to remind some of the members and maybe some of the newer members what exactly a credit union is. And a credit union is a not-for-profit financial cooperative where the leadership is chosen from the membership, by the membership. Credit unions, because they're nonprofits, don't have that for-profit motive, so we can put those savings back into lower interest rates, lower and fewer fees, and higher yields on savings. Oftentimes I'll get this question, who can belong to a credit union? I often will say nobody can join every credit union, but everybody can join one. Basically, the parameters are you have to live, work, or belong to a membership group that allows you access to a specific credit union. And just, I wanted to throw this slide in here real briefly, just to note that the first credit union in Minnesota was actually chartered in 1925. So in a couple of years, we've got one that's going to be breaking its 100-year anniversary. And that's pretty exciting for us. Just a lot of history in Minnesota of credit unions and how big a part of the communities that they are. Also of note, there are two types of credit unions. There are state charter and federal charter. State charter are primarily regulated by the State Department of Commerce and Chapter 52 in the Minnesota state statutes. Federal charters are governed by the Federal Credit Union Act and are more prominently regulated by the National Credit Union Administration, which also functions much like the FDIC for us in that it offers federal insurance for deposits on accounts. All Minnesota credit unions are statutorily required to have federal insurance and backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government, always important to mention. And like Mr. Witt said, we are a heavily regulated industry, and that's good reason. We want to make sure that we're protecting our members' money. Through risk-focused examinations, we have quarterly call reports, so where we report to the NCUA on basically all the different accounts and business accounts that we do, as well as supervisory committees within the credit unions themselves. Just a quick note on actual Minnesota credit union stats. We are currently at 88 credit unions with just about 400 branches representing about 2.1 million members. Representative Cleavorn's question about consolidation and Representative Liebling's question too. We are also experiencing a lot of consolidation over the last few years. When I started with the network back in 2012, I think the number was 145 credit unions. So we're averaging a number of credit unions every year that are merging into other ones and out of existence. So we haven't had any fail, or the state of our industry is strong, but we have had a lot of industry consolidation, and for the most part, that tends to be on the smaller credit union size into the larger ones. But with that being said, we still have just about half of our membership is under 100 million in assets, so we still have a good number of small community-based credit unions that are in those communities, greater Minnesota, in the cities, what have you. For the most part, about half are 100 million in assets and under. Some of the financial benefits of Minnesota credit unions: we provided 135 million in direct financial benefits to our 2.1 million members in Minnesota. That's through lower loan rates, higher savings rates, and fewer and lower fees. Basically, that breaks down to equivalent of about $67 per member or $140 per household. Our economic performance continues to be pretty strong. Our loan and savings growth rates have trended up. Interestingly, and I think probably this, anybody that pays attention to the news would see this, that especially through the first part of last year, our loan growth actually dramatically, almost three times as much, superseded savings growth, growth in savings accounts. That's starting to, the interest rate market right now is kind of shifting that, both for homes, for cars, but the first half of last year, we had tremendous growth in our loan portfolios. Credit unions do a ton of financial education in every community that you all represent and that our members are in. We actually have six school credit union branches in high schools across the state, including one in Eden Prairie. And we have over 100 Minnesota credit union employees that have a certified financial credit union counselor designation. So financial literacy is a key part of what we do. We also try to ensure financial well-being for all. Our federal trade association, the Credit Union National Association, commissions a national voter poll every year, and nearly 90% of credit union members say that their credit union has improved their financial well-being. We just have a really, really high touch on our members, and it's something that really is certainly a focus on what we do and just making sure that we can help our members live their best financial lives. Notably, one of the policy things that we worked on, I think it was back in 2015, was to allow financial institutions in Minnesota to offer what's called price-linked savings accounts. That bill was passed in the House and Senate with bipartisan majorities back in 2015, allowing us to create what's called Wincentive. Basically, it's an incentive for people to put money away. It basically creates a program where people can win drawings. It almost functions like a lottery, but in that you don't actually have any way to lose any money. So it really encourages folks to save. Nationally, about 50% of people can't come up with $400 in emergency money if they have, need a car repair or whatever. And so this program was set up to help kind of address that shortfall. Since we started in 2016, we have about almost 8,800 Wincentive savings accounts across the state. It's the median account balance now is $376. So these are small dollar amounts, money that has been saved that is probably would not have been saved otherwise. And one last thing I want to touch on, Mr. Chair, before I wrap up. Every year, we started a few years ago, something
very,
called...
Very, very, very briefly.
Like I said, brevity. It's my watchword for the day. The CU Forward Day is a day of service that we started during Columbus Day every year, since a banking holiday, where we send our folks out into the communities to volunteer at whatever they... whatever is impactful in their communities. In this last year, back in October, we had 66 credit unions and 3,000 volunteers volunteer about 1,300 hours altogether. So it's something that we're really proud of and just really demonstrates our touch in our communities. Mr. Chair, that concludes my presentation here, but I'm happy to take any questions.
And I'm afraid we're going to have to take those questions offline. We don't have time for member questions just now, but thank you, Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The next and final testifier in this section is Mr. Amundson. From the community bankers, Mr. Amundson, if you could come forward, and again, bonus points for brevity today. We're running late on time, and that's our fault. I apologize to you for that, but
no,
we'll be seeing
necessary.
You again, I know. So.
Yes. Well, Mr. Chair, members of the Commerce Committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here. As was just stated, my name is Jim Amundson, and I'm the president and CEO of Bank In Minnesota. When I saw the agenda, gaming and banking, I was going to focus my comments on crypto, but we'll leave that for another day. But I'm proud to represent community banks in the state of Minnesota. And if you leave with two things today, which I will be very brief, you formerly knew us perhaps as the Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota, which in and of itself is quite a mouthful. And so while that was part of the reason we moved to Bank In Minnesota, there are other more strategic reasons for it. I just want you to walk away knowing that when you see Bank In Minnesota, that you understand that we're still the Community Bank Trade Association in the state of Minnesota, representing only community banks. And we went that way for a number of different reasons, but we're primarily looking to build a platform where we can speak to the public on behalf of our industry and do it with a more recognizable brand and maybe something that's easier to remember. Secondly, in your packet, it might have got posted late, but there's a cute little graphic, maybe even corny. If you spend a little time with that, it'll help you understand the differences, why our industry is important, why we are worthy of preservation and protection. And that relates to the fact that in all these communities, there's 250-plus community banks in the state of Minnesota. The impact and the relationship that individuals in those communities, the community banks, and the businesses and family farms have in supporting one another, creating jobs, creating opportunities, creating quality of life, that each one depends on the other, and it's unique to this industry. It's unique across the country and certainly unique in Minnesota. So I'd like you to just take those two things away and then offer myself as a contact at any point. My contact information is in the packet. We also work with Goff Public, Elizabeth Emerson and her team. They're here day to day at the Capitol, but so you'll see them more than me, but I'm available at any time. So I know we don't have time for questions, but please reach out if there are any, and thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Amundson. And I apologize for the brevity today. We just ran a little over on other things. We're move to the next item on our agenda, which is House File 94. I'll welcome Chair Noor to the committee. I will move House File 94 be recommended to be placed on the general register. And Representative Noor, I note you have an author's amendment, the A1 amendment. I will move the A1 amendment. And Representative Noor, do you want to describe the A1?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. A1 amendment simply changes the limit so that it conforms with the bill itself. So this is removing the 1 million limit, and we will be increasing it to 10 million as per the federal regulations that have changed.
Discussion to the A1 amendment. Representative O'Driscoll.
Mr. Chair, just a procedural. I don't know what committee was this being referred to. I don't think we did that part. I think we just went right to the amendment.
No, Representative O'Driscoll, I move that it be placed in the general register.
I'm sorry.
Any further discussion? Seeing no discussion, all in favor of the A1 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Noor, if you could describe your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chen. Members, as the bill as amended, Mr. Chen, members, this creates an opportunity for small businesses who are going to be using securities under the state regulations to be able to raise capital through equity and to be able to get the resource that they need. This is more about providing them capital in a time whereby the banks may not offer them, other places may not exist. So this helps people beyond the accredited investors, and it's an exemption under the federal regulations. Mr. Chair and members, this is a simple bill that creates more opportunity for small businesses. And I'll ask for your support, and we're changing the limit right now based on the federal rules that have changed to $10 million instead of the $1 million, as you can see in the Minnesota rules, but 2876-30-21.
Thank you, Representative Norton. I see that Representative Driscoll has a question, but we do have a testifier before that, so we will get to you, Representative Driscoll. And the testifier is Mr. Kelly from the Commerce Department. Mr. Kelly.
Hello, Mr. Chair and members. My name is John Kelly. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the Commerce Department. We're going with brevity today. We support this reasonable change to the Blue Sky Laws in Minnesota, appreciate the amendment that updates the rule as what the corresponding rule. That's it.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. Members, discussion and question, Representative O'Driscoll.
Mr. Chair, I would like to have Mr. Kelly come back. This question is really more to him than it is probably to the bill author. If he maybe could explain why we're striking lines 1, 15, and 1, 16 in the amendment, why the $1 million limit just for members' edification.
Mr. Kelly, if you could speak to that.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, so the change in the statute removes the it ties the cap, for lack of a better word, to what's in the federal limit, which is currently $10 million, and that is going to be the cap. And we struck the $1 million. So as the cap is updated in the CFR, Minnesota state statutes will just follow that along rather than having that limit.
Any further discussion to the bill? Representative Miska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to maybe take that one step further, this prevents us from having to do future work in the future when the feds change it, right?
Mr. Kelly.
Mr. Chair, Representative Miska, that's correct.
Any further discussion to the bill? Seeing none, Representative Nora, I'll give you the final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you've had, this is just conforming with the federal regulations that have changed. In fact, it changed from $1 million to $5 million. We didn't update our systems, and now it's from $5 million to $10 million, which quite frankly helps people who are not accredited. For those who know about it, you have to have a $200,000 or have a million asset and so many other conditions that people cannot participate in the securities. So this is an option for those small businesses to be able to create more opportunity, including taking advantage of the angel tax credit and also the SSBCI, which is a federal program that people can combine, especially for those who are seeking venture capital. This is more of a startup and provides a better opportunity for so many small businesses. I'll ask for your support. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Chair Noor. With no further discussion, I will renew my motion that House File 94, as amended, to be recommended to be placed on the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails, and House File 94 is amended, is recommended to be placed on the general register. It concludes the business of the committee for the day, and so the committee is adjourned.